So, Jack, you have just gone back to Berlin and you have become adjutant of your battalion.
That's right, yeah. And we were in Spandau, which is in the British zone, of course, just on the outskirts of the city itself. We were part of 130 Brigade of the 43rd Division, and we had three battalions in Berlin at that time. And my battalion was the 5th Dorsets. The other two battalions was the 4th Dorsets and the 7th Hampshires. The most of our time, frankly, was as an army of occupation, patrolling, enforcing things. But, of course, all in the face of Russian intervention, Russian interference, and so on. Although we enabled us, I mean, one weren't doing any really serious soldiering, frankly. I mean, much of it was ceremonial or taking part in parades or just showing the flag, so to speak. A certain amount of contact with the Russians. The opportunity to see Berlin. That's what I did. I went to down the bunker. So I got there and I went to the Reich Chancellery and Hitler's study, and I've got a bit of Hitler's study somewhere in this house. And gradually see a rundown of the battalion because people from age and service group being demobilised and going back home. So we lost a few of those and we lost a few officers. And we were there until about August.
Can I ask, what was the, that's now 15, 18 months after the war ended, what is the, people are starting to go back to the UK, you just mentioned, but what was the morale and spirit of the ordinary troops? Were they saying to themselves, what are we still doing here, why can't we go home, or did they naturally acquiesce in further military
service? No, I think a mixture. I mean, there were obviously those that just simply wanted to go home. There were those that had every intention of continuing in the army in some way or another. And there were those that who had very limited service and realised they still had a year or two before they would go home. Of course, Berlin was a marvellous station, really, because it had every resources and facilities. There was a lot of potential entertainment, and certainly as far as officers were concerned, there was everything you can do. And I was very fortunate, extremely fortunate, because the general that was in charge of the what was called Information Services Division of the Control Commission was based in Berlin. A lot of the top Control Commission people were based in Berlin, and he was based in Berlin, and he happened to be an officer in my regiment, Major General Bishop by name, and he knew me, and he was a fairly cultural type officer. That's why he's doing the job, I suppose. But he had his own private box in the Staatsoper there, which he didn't use, and he gave it to me. And so I was able to go to the Staatsoper whenever I wanted to, in my own box, and invite others to go in his box, and which I did. And I can remember seeing Martha six times in a fortnight once. But more importantly, the Berlin Philharmonic. I saw a lot of the Berlin Philharmonic, including rehearsals. I got to know Chelyabodarky, who was the conductor in those days of the Berlin Philharmonic. I'm very fond of music, so it was marvellous, really. So I got a bit of culture out of all that. And that was a great opportunity, which I must say many officers didn't bother to take up. I think we had a very good officer club, so we'd go to a club probably almost every, I won't say every night, but most nights for a meal, drink, and life was fairly comfortable, really.
Before we turn to the life that the ordinary troops led, can I just ask a question about the state of Berlin? I had no idea that the Staatsoper was standing. What was the condition of Berlin?
Appalling. I mean, it was in terrible condition. But not everywhere. But I mean, the area around Spandau and Wilmersdorf and that part of Berlin was reasonable. The centre of Berlin, I mean, around the Reichstag and around the Chancellery and all around there, was very badly damaged. Very badly damaged. Reichstag was a wreck, of course. And the Tiergarten had, of course, been demolished completely because the Germans cut all the trees down for fuel. So there was no trees in the Tiergarten. There was, it was a wasteland, really. And of course, on the Russian side, the Russians did nothing about trying to improve things whatsoever. We at least, on the British side and the American side, had all these gangs of German men and women rebuilding, clearing the waste. And mind you, they didn't need much encouragement. They would want to do it themselves anyway. But people were still living in cellars or in buildings for which, second and third floor up, one wall would be missing. Somehow or another they survived in it. We had a certain amount of dealings with the Russians. I mean, we occasionally went to a Russian regiment for a meal, Russian officers. We'd have Russian officers come to us. And we had a Russian liaison officer in the battalion for some time. I can remember one day, I came down to breakfast, and Russian officer, he spoke English, very good English, and said, you know, he suddenly got up and said, goodbye, he's going. We had no warning or anything like that. He says, I had been called back, and it was fairly clear that they decided he'd been too anglicised with us. He probably came back almost certain execution. He knew it. Oh yeah, he knew it too.
So he was happy to.
Well,
I wouldn't say happy, but I mean, there was an inevitability which he didn't attempt to.
Well, later on, I mean, I can illustrate it by this. Later on, I got very much involved with Russian defectors and. Oh yes, Russian defectors and people like that. And I can remember several times having to hand Russians back to the Russians, you know, the defectors, and we decided we didn't want them and we handed them back. And they were quite resigned to it. They never sort of argued or fought back or anything, and you knew well they were going to be executed. And in those days it was quite common for the Russians to take them round, troops, in a cage, and show them off. Well, what happens to you if you defect? This is what will happen to you. And show the caged Russian defector. That was normal. And they knew that. They're fatalistic Russians.
But this man was not a defector. This man was...
Oh, no, he was a serving major in the Russian army. Liaison officer to us. But he knew jolly well that he was in trouble. There was only one thing. He may not be shot, but he certainly went to Siberia. So it's very sad the way they behaved. Mind you, they were pretty appalling. I mean, the state of their dress and everything else was absolutely frightful. Yeah. On the other hand, I remember the Victory Day. I was there on Victory Day, April, we taking part in the victory parade along the right down the main street in Berlin, which I can't remember the name of. Yeah, we went to Linden. Yeah, and the British Brigade. We had one battalion was produced from the British Brigade. In fact, it was my battalion. To take part in that parade, and it wasn't a whole battalion even then. I think it was only about two companies, and the Americans, and there we are, smart, polished. So we all turned up, and I don't know if it was Zhukov or Sokolovsky who was the commander in chief. He took the salute anyway. Whoever it was, he took the salute. Then we went down the end. And we turned up to a British battalion, American battalion, and a Russian division. And as smart as anything. They absolutely, it was unbelievable. Complete with tanks. And it was just like, you know, something, you know, the Moscow October parade or whatever.
Yeah.
That's the way they did it. But they could do that occasionally, but the rest of the time they were a road of scruffs and totally ill-disciplined.
And difficult to deal with?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And this was then...
And of course none of them spoke any language you could understand. I mean, if you spoke to them in German, they didn't speak German. I'm talking about soldiers. They didn't speak German, they didn't speak English. And there was no way of communicating with them. Russian, some Russian officers could.
But they had some German or some English?
Well, you could either do it in some German or some of them spoke some English. You could, for several officers, be able to communicate. But any other ranks, quite impossible.
And were there incidents between British and Russian soldiers?
Yeah, quite a lot, because the Russians would get drunk. And they get drunk on petrol. I mean they just wanted a drink all the time.
Yes, that wasn't the incident I was thinking of. I was thinking that there were difficulties caused, deliberate difficulties caused by orders from higher up the Russian command in order just to be difficult towards...
Well, it was quite clear that by about that time there were problems beginning to emerge. In fact, they'd probably long before then. But I'm not certain it directly affected us. We were not coming up against any real problem. I mean, you got the odd one, you know, they would misbehave themselves in the British zone, and our military police would pick them up, and that would cause a problem.
So it was quite possible for troops to move across from the Russian zone to the British zone?
Oh, yeah, because there was no, you had freedom of movement. And I mean, we spent a lot of time in the Russian sector, because that's where you wanted to go to see things. And there was no problem. That was long before the wall and, you know, eventually the wall. But there was completely free movement. And then both sides, of course. But the Russians were not, they didn't have so much free movement because they were under control. They really often come in busloads. Whereas we could go across to them individually, they would come across in organised busloads. And one saw them a lot that way. But your odd vehicle would sometimes be stopped by a couple of Russians aggressively and try and pinch the vehicle off you or pinch the petrol. And that did happen quite a lot. As they were so well disciplined. I mean, it was not their best troops were in Berlin at the time. I think that was probably their intention, to punish the Germans as much as possible. Having read this recent book by the author of Stalingrad, you know, Berlin.
Anthony Grieber.
Yeah. The picture he painted in Berlin, about Berlin, was certainly the picture that was told to us by a number of Germans. Exactly that. And I got to know, the CO was also a Catholic. We did have, Dorset's a not very Catholic part of the country. So we didn't have many Catholics in the battalion, but I was one of a dozen or so in the CO. And we go to Mass on a Sunday morning and go and then have breakfast in a place where the priest used to live, which was above a CW Catholic Women's League canteen, which we always invited to that a number of nuns, German nuns. And the rape cases they told us about was they'd been raped, these German nuns. So I learned about that as early as those days. They told us a lot about the way they were treated.
Immediately after after May 45.
Well, that was probably also during the attack on Berlin.
Right.
And because by this time they were now living in the Western sector, and therefore safe and well protected. But I think those in the East sector may well have still been suffering from all sorts of things. Well, I mean, it was evident because there was a lot of refugees coming, and they would do their damnedest to get into the British zone, and they would smuggle themselves on trains, hide away on trains.
So there was an attempt to prevent these people from coming across.
Oh, absolutely.
By the Russians? No, absolutely.
By Russians. Why I don't think we were particularly worried about it at the time.
Was there any indication given as to why the Russians wanted to keep German refugees in their sector? What's the advantage, I wonder, to the Russians to do that? Did you get any indication?
Well, no, I think at that time, I don't think there was any real pressure on their part. They were too disorganised, frankly, to have handled that situation. Later on, of course, it was a reflection on the regime and, you know, the defectors and all that went with it. We still got, for a long time, quite a lot of refugees would come into the British zone. I mean, we had camps specially for them, and indeed to encourage them to come to defect. But initially, there was a lot of people just in fear, or because the families were split. They had people living in the British or American sectors who they wanted to come and rejoin their family. And I can remember, I mean, eventually we were living in Celle in Western Germany, as it is, became. It's just north of Hanover. And we had a cook and a man that worked in the house, and they were both refugees. They'd both come across on the train, hidden away. They came to us, so it was fairly common.
Before we turn back to your duties and tasks this time in occupied Berlin, I just want to quickly go back and touch on the state of conditions for the ordinary troops. You said that the officers were fairly well catered for, that there was plenty of entertainment, certainly.
There was aimed for the troops.
And for the troops.
Oh,
as
absolutely.
Well.
Yeah. Oh, plenty.
So they were well catered for.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I mean, there were clubs and naffies and all sorts of things, and to a very high standard, really. I suppose by those days, I mean, we were seeing things we hadn't seen for a long time. Alcohol was available, plenty of cigarettes, and there was no problem. And people traded on the black market. I mean, that's the truth of the matter.
My next question was, how did the ordinary German survive? Where did the food come from? Because one assumes that the normal civil structure of the city had broken down.
They survived on a breadline, really. I mean, it was desperate. I mean, I think their rations were limited to probably less than 1,400 calories a day, unless they were doing heavy manual work, miners, and that had, I remember, 3,500 calories or something. If they were doing heavy manual work or reasonably manual work, they got a bit more. But frankly, it was starvation level. And that was probably went on for about a year. And therefore, what they would do would, whatever possessions they still had, they traded those.
In return for food?
In return for coffee, which became a currency. Coffee became a currency, so they had coffee, they could use that to trade for other things. So troops would, and cigarettes. So you troops got free cigarettes, 50 a week or something, but you could get more than that.
50 a week?
I think it was 50 a week. Yeah, 50 a week in a sealed tin. Yes, I did smoke then, yes. But anyway, and people would trade cigarettes on the black market for a radio or a whatever, you know, camera. And that was the way the Germans were able to, because if they had nothing to trade, and a lot of them clearly didn't at the end of the day, they had nothing.
And it took a year for the for the civil structure to get into place to be able to feed these people.
Yes. If I could jump ahead a bit, I think it is important. The most dramatic thing that happened was currency reform in 1948, where the Reichsmark was removed and we introduced the Deutschmark. My brigade, because I wasn't in the battalion then, my brigade, which we were now in Celle, and we handled a part of that operation. And it really was dramatic, because what happened was, we were all being told there was going to be a major census of the whole of Western Germany. And we were to move all these census forms to locations, to the banks. And then the census would then be carried out from there. On the particular day, trains would arrive from other parts of Germany, probably out from Frankfurt somewhere, with the census forms into Celle station, where they were sealed in, a big wire fence all around it, and guarded. And then on the next day, we had to send trucks all over the place to the banks with the census forms. And it's the only time in my life I've ever seen, at that time, anything like it. Because each truck had an officer guard, an officer led guard. Every truck had an officer led guard of about half a dozen men. And a piece of paper on a board which said, on it was the effect, this truck must not be stopped, and this order will be enforced by shooting. So that meant a military policeman stopped it to say, where are you going? Why? Where's your driving license or whatever? You can't stop us. If he argued about it, he could be in trouble. I don't think anybody ever got shot, but it's the only time I've ever seen such a piece of paper written. And they moved into the banks. The banks were taken over, sealed, guarded. And of course, the sense of force was currency. No one knew that was what happened. And then on the Monday morning, it was all announced, your money is worthless, and you can change, at that time, 50 Deutsch, 50 Mark, you can draw X number of Reichsmarks for 50 Deutschmarks. And no more. And all the British troops were allowed 50 Deutschmarks and more. Not much more, but more. We became the wealthiest people in Germany. But what did it do? All the farmers, all the hoarders, their stuff came out. Suddenly, all these empty shops that no one had ever seen anything in other than a toy doll or a stick of sausage or something, was full of things.
Where had it come from?
Been hidden away. Because the Reichsmark was useless, they weren't going to sell anything. So all these carpets, the thousands of carpets and valuable furniture that the farmers had, that they'd been trading their crops for, suddenly were released on the market and everything. And we never looked back. And that's what did it. And that was all backed by American money. Because they backed the Reichsmark. And from then, Germany never looked back.
Yes.
And of course, all the fortunes in Reichsmarks were worthless. They gradually got a few more, and after a little while, a couple of weeks later, they were allowed to draw another 80 marks or something. And of course, the key thing was, all the Germans that were employed by the British forces or the occupying powers were the wealthiest Germans, because they were paid in Deutschmarks a proper salary. None of them had any money, so that became a prime objective of wanting to get a job with the British. And I mean, our maid was one of the wealthiest Germans.
Let's go back then, Jack, to what your job was, because I think that you did say at one stage that you acquired a reputation for being a fine defence counsel. Or was that much later?
Well, that was a bit later. Well, what happened was, I mean, I was agent of the battalion, and eventually the battalion came out of Germany, because we were TA battalion, 5th battalion, and we were going into what is called suspended animation, So we left Berlin, and I had the job of arranging all that move out of Berlin and that to Celle, or to Lüneburg actually, not Celle, to Lüneburg, where the battalion virtually disbanded. And I had the job of arranging all that, writing all the orders, who was going to go when and whatever. And eventually all the officers had gone, the CO had gone, and I was the last officer. I was myself and the quartermaster and the doctor. I've got a photograph of the three of us saying goodbye to each other. And we were the last three in Lüneburg. And I then went as battalion intelligence officer to 130 Brigade of 7th Armour Division, which was in Celle. And that's really where I really got into intelligence properly. So from then onwards, we were in Celle. Kathleen joined us with my eldest son as a baby in 1946. She was one of the first wives out to Germany. And we were there until we eventually the brigade eventually disbanded. And I went to Brigade Intelligence Officer 130 Brigade of 7th Armour Division. Oh, sorry, the first one was 15 Brigade. And I went to 130 Brigade in Hanover, where we were doing mainly an occupational role, patrolling the demarcation line and handling. We were up against a certain amount of... It happened in 15 Brigade too, when I was in Celle. We were up against the main threat. No, not a main threat. A major threat was the Jewish underground. And Urgus von Lume, Stern gang, carrying out sabotage against the British. And we had Belsen Camp, which was in our brigade. And a lot of the underground activities were organised from Belsen Camp.
And this is in 1946, 47?
Yeah, and 48, and 49.
And there were Jewish activities,
oh, yeah,
Jewish terrorists operating in Germany against British troops.
Yeah, because it was all a part of the Palestine issue. I mean, they sabotaged the railway line, they tried to blow up the line to Berlin. They were doing all sorts of sabotage. But more particularly, smuggling and that. I mean, one would carry out checks on, I can remember many occasions, I mean, checks going into, people going into Belsen Camp. Because Belsen Camp by this time was a Jewish refugee camp, and there was 15,000 Jews in there. Yeah. And
so it had been converted from a concentration camp, completely cleaned up.
That's right.
And became a
Jewish camp. Well, there was they were really using the barracks of the old... the guards and that. There was a big barracks there. And that was one of the centres of Jewish resistance organisation, and partly to smuggle into Jews into Palestine. And they had their direct links to America, to New York. We used to monitor the telephone lines, and people in charge, the Jewish people in charge of the Jews in the camp, would be in direct contact with their bosses in America. And we would raid that camp, you know, every now and again, and find all sorts of things. Hidden presses, currency forgeries, identity papers forgeries, and things like that. But on several occasions, well, I remember every one example, just to illustrate the point, you know, a couple of Jews would be going along the... I'm rather pro-Jewish, by the way, I'm not anti-Jewish, anyway. But there'd be a couple of Jews going along the pavement, and be stopped by a couple of soldiers, and be carrying probably rabbis, and probably carrying great big suitcases. I never at the time realised, I've learned since, they'd open the suitcases, and they'd be full of diamonds. We're talking about millions of pounds worth of stuff. I didn't really know until I went to Palestine, I went to Israel, you know, a year or two ago, that their expertise, the diamond trade in Israel, that and Holland, Amsterdam, and that is the centre of the world. I never realised at that time, you know, that was a factor in the fact that they had these great big boxes of diamonds, which of course were being used to finance their operations. But that was not uncommon to find that sort of thing. And I was involved in several raids on Belt Encampment, and we'd have a whole brigade do the raid. I mean, we're talking about 3 battalions. It's not just a couple of people. I mean, it really was a massive operation. But the moment you arrived in, they'd be on the phone to New York to get the United Nations to order us to, I mean the UN, to order us to stop the raid. And we'd be held out whilst this debate was going on. And then somehow or another, commander-in-chief in Germany would say, carry on, you know, continue. A lot of the personalities at that time, whose names I've now forgotten, but were very well-known people at the time in that world.